Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 91, titled Tibetan Buddhism is not really Tibetan.
Now, first thing I want to say is that Tibetan Buddhism is not Tibetan Buddhism. That's the first thing. That's a very Buddhist way of putting it, also. And what I mean by that is that, we do have, Japanese Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism. We talk like that. And nowadays people are talking, where's the American Buddhism? Some youngsters especially are going, we got to have American Buddhism. And what is that, you know? And in a way, those terms seem to imply that Buddhism is sort of made in those countries, and it's like the product of Tibet, or it's the product of wherever. Even Indian Buddhism is a wrong word, because in Buddha's time, there was no India. There were 16 city-states in the northern Indian subcontinent, what we now call the Indian subcontinent. And there was no nation of India, and there was hundreds of nations there. There's still 300 language groups in India. You know, there's so many. It's a huge multinational, multicultural subcontinent is what India actually is. And there is, when they tried to make Hindi the national language of India, the people in the south of India like were burning buses and freaking out. You know, they didn't want it. It was really a colonial construct. The Indian nation, what do you call the Indian nation, you know? The British, you know? The capital in Delhi was a capital modeled on the Greek capital made by Indigo Jones. It's a total British trip, you know? But they're still keeping it up, and that's okay. And but really, the Punjab and Tamil Nadu and Kerala and Karnataka and Mysore and Andhra Pradesh and Bengal, these are different nations, you know? They're really different nations in their own self. The UP, the United Province UP in central Gangetic India, is 280 million people or something. It's like a big one of the, by itself, it would be one of the biggest nations in the world. So therefore, Tibetan Buddhism is not really Tibetan. What it really is the Tibetans were lucky enough to receive from Bihar, central India, which now is central India, then was just Bihar, state of Bihar, and from the great monastic universities there, and other parts, and Kashmir and Bengal, other parts of India, monastic universities there, they received a civilization, if you will, like a way of doing things, way of understanding life, and brought to them by many great, is anybody in that chair? There's a chair there, ma'am. There's another one. There you go. Brought to them by these great masters, teachers. Some of them were monks. Some of them were hippies. Like siddhas, what they call great adepts, like yogi, hippie types, you know. Many of them were enlightened and therefore clairvoyant about the processes of history. And they foresaw that what was the Indian civilization matrix would be overrun by outsiders eventually, which happened often in Indian history, even in the thousands of years before, because India is such an attractive place. It is in Eurasia, the Indus and the Ganges are the two most wealthy alluvia, river plains. Fertilizable floodplains, to grow food, and there's a seat up here. There's another one here. Don't have to go too far back, but that's nice.
Thank you.
And so they received this new kind of civilization, and they received it in the case of Tibet. When here's a chair, Karen, over here. I know everybody. Like this is like a dinner party or something. And And they received it at a time when they had a big empire, and they got still bigger after they first received it. They still had the momentum of having an empire. But it was a very large Central Asian empire. They were very fierce people. But the rulers of that empire realized, of course, that they had kind of reached their maximum expansion. Having reached their maximum expansion, the ethic that holds together a conquest empire, which is an ethic that people are conquering, getting something from other people, and therefore they have to keep expanding so there's more to feed the people, or else they turn on each other and it becomes very, very unstable, and they start fighting and trying to get stuff away from each other. So when you reach that maximum expansion, you can either voluntarily or involuntarily lose the empire and turn your attention inward to the quality of your life and whether you wish to be happy or you wish to just clomp around beating people over the head and grabbing their stuff. Those are the two choices. So Tibet was in that state, and the rulers realized that in order to have the Tibetans live peacefully and look at the quality of their life, they couldn't constantly be conquering. The lucky thing for Tibet's neighbors during that imperial conquest phase was that they liked living at 2 or 3 miles altitude. So they never really tried to colonize and settle down, except a little bit in the Silk Route. They left garrisons to control the Silk Route. But otherwise, they'd go and conquer some low altitude place and loot and pillage a bit and get some, you know, bring some tea or something back and then rush back with gold and sea and wealth and things like that. But they didn't want to stay there. You know, it wasn't like the British, who came from a place with a lousy climate and only tin mines and terrible food, and therefore definitely wanted to settle down in India or any other more cozy place, you know. And the Tibetans were happy up there on their mountaintops, you know, with their yaks. So then they brought this different ethic, and this is an ethic of civilized life. And what is civilized life? Civilized life is not having cars and subways and toilets. Civilized life, you know, is being gentle with others, altruistic, you know, and not collectivist in a coercive way where you're forced by some authority to march around and do whatever, you know, serve the state, you know, or serve somebody. But rather an individual thing where the individual is encouraged to flourish, and yet in their flourishing they realize or they are taught or they come to understand that you only flourish when you help others to flourish. That the secret of happiness is making others happy, which is the secret of life. As Dalai Lama likes to say, if you want to be happy, be compassionate, be altruistic. If you want to be successfully selfish, be a wise selfish and make yourself happy by making others happy. He constantly gives that seemingly paradoxical slogan, but actually very pragmatic instruction. He always does. So this is the kind of ethic, this is the Buddhist ethic, and this is what they received, the Tibetans. And they received it in a time in the history of Indian Buddhism. Now I'm using the term Indian Buddhism. These are conventional terms. As I said, there is no Indian Buddhism, but anyway, I'm going to use the term. So you know it's a placeholder, an illusory term. So they received it. I lost track. I was worried about your seat, but you got a good seat. I lost track of what I was saying. They received it from a time in the history of Indian Buddhism when the full force of the Buddhist civilizing education system was functioning. And what do I mean by the full force? On pages 16 and 17 here, this book I'm holding is a book I wrote called Essential Tibetan Buddhism. And it's mostly a translation, but I love my own introduction because it's a good introduction. It really is good. And I use it in my classes, you know, that I have at school because it has a good summary. And I talk about vehicles or styles of education or teaching of Buddhism in India. And for the first 500 years, I call it the individualistic style of monastic Buddhism. And this is what nowadays people know of as Theravada Buddhism, you know, Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, especially. Although what people don't know is that in China and Tibet and the Mahayana Buddhist countries, the monastic ethic of monastic Buddhism, same as Sri Lanka, same tradition, is held by many monks and nuns, so that there are no other monastic vows. The Mahayana doesn't have monastic vows. Vajrayana doesn't have, it has bodhisattva vows, and Vajrayana has tantric vows, but the monastic vow is only the individualistic style monastic Buddhism. And why do I say individualistic style? That, of course, shocks Western people, because Western people think they're the individualists. You know, we're rugged Americans. We're real individualists. But actually, I always tease my students, and I might as well tease you, in case you think that. You're educated to think that, of course, that the Westerners are the individualists. And because we have God, that makes us individualistic. Or we have the Greeks, and that makes us individualistic. And we're taught to think that. But I always say, take the... if you want to see individualism in action, like in India, here in America, then you have to do, I tell them there's an experiment you can do. What you do is you strip yourself naked, you paint some stripes on your body, maybe you get a big staff, like a trident-looking staff or something, some kind of imposing-looking staff. Let your hair grow long and make a nice cow caca coiffure of cow dung, and then walk down Broadway, you know, up at Columbia, I say Broadway. Go down Broadway going Buddha, Buddha, or Ram, Ram, or Jesus, Jesus, whatever religion, doesn't matter. And then go to Ollie's noodle shop and demand free lunch and see how far you get. And of course, you'd be arrested, tranquilized, injected, Bellevue, you know, like electroshock therapy, whatever. But in India, there's 80 million people who do like that, even today. And of course, the great model of individualism in a way is actually truly Buddhism. It's Buddha's life story. You know, Buddha was a prince and a crown prince, and then he had a son. He and his wife had a son. And then the father said, well, okay, great, you have a son. He's the new crown prince. You're the new king. I'm going to take a break and go to Florida. And Buddha said, sorry, Dad. I know you'd like to do that. That is our tradition. But I have discovered death, old age, sickness, suffering, birth, all of the horrors of life. And I want to help. And you told me as a king I should be helping my people. And those are my people's real problems. I want to help them with those problems. And the king said, son, that's for the priest. That's religion. The guts in the hands of the gods. You can't do anything about that. You just have to run the country in a proper manner. And Buddha said, sorry, I think I can. And if the gods are in charge, they're not doing a good job. I want to do a better job. And then the father did what they do in that kind of circumstance, locked him up and sent in the psychiatrists, which in this case were Brahmin priests, who were giving him the religious thing about do your duty. So then he did what individual young people do when their parents want them to follow in the family business. He escaped. And he went out into the jungle and he sought the truth. He sought reality. You know? He sought the answer to the question, why am I here? What am I doing here? You know, why am I? What is the purpose of my life? You know, how many of you feel you know what is the purpose of your life? For example, now. What? No hand? Oh, you know. Oh, good. She knows. She's an artist, so she knows. She's an artist. Good. I'm not going to embarrass you by asking. So others, I'm sure, think they do or do, and they are just not raising their hand. So that was kind of the source. And then he created this institution, which is really difficult to create. Imagine going to Mayor Bloomberg today and saying, Mayor, you're not going to be mayor much longer. What I want you now to do is make sure that anybody in New York who wants to find out the true purpose of life and is willing to shave their head and clean up their act and wear like a orange robe and not have too much property and not accumulate things, but they, and you're going to make a place for them to stay free place, nice, free, safe place, and you're going to give them a free lunch for life so they can find it, fulfill themselves, find out what the story is. Do you think that Bloomberg, with his $30 billion, would do that? I think it would be a hard sell. Yet Buddha went, after he attained enlightenment, which was, in his understanding, the understanding the nature of reality fully and completely, is what it is. He actually did meet the gods. It isn't that he didn't meet the gods. He met them, but he found that they didn't know the answer either. They were just like, especially the creator god, the one who was cracked up to be the creator, it was Brahma in India. And when he met Brahma, he said, okay, Brahma, I'm looking for the meaning of life. You created it. What's the meaning? And Brahma, after some funny exchange, eventually said, actually, I didn't create it. I don't know how it happened, and I don't know what the meaning is, but I'm a god, and I'm smart, and I can see you're smarter. And I can tell you will figure it out. You'll become a Buddha, what they call a Buddha. And when you do, I ask for two favors. And then, what is that? Buddha said. And God said to Buddha, the so-called creator of the time, he said, come tell me how it works and what it's all about. That's one. And two, tell the human beings when things go really bad for them, when their children die, when they're suffering, when there's a war, when there's a plague, a famine, whatever, when they're really in misery, it's not my fault. I didn't create it. I'm not omnipotent. I do my best for everyone that I can help. I'm a powerful God, but I'm not omnipotent, and I'm not the creator. That's actually written 2,500 years ago. That story, you know, whatever its real reality is, it's an amazing story, actually. So he did meet the God, like prophets of religions do. But as I say, when God said, you know, this and that, he said, well, why? And what's the reason? And what's it about? And God was unable to answer that. So he had to find out that understanding for himself. And he did, and then he was happy. Because when he understood the nature of reality, this is one of the key things about Buddhism, any kind of Buddhism, and the foundation of Buddhism, is that reality itself, as hard to believe as that may be in this moment, poised on the brink of the next Middle East war, or the continuing Middle East war, reality itself, if you understand it, is perfectly all right. Life or death or whatever it is, up or down, life is fabulous. It is made of happiness, if you will. It's like my body, I'm sick and golfing and having this problem, I'm old and my legs creak and whatever. But actually the bone itself is made of an energy of bliss, was what the Buddha discovered. And you know, I'm repeating it because he said so. To me it's an aching bone. Most of the time. Sometimes a little bit when I'm reading a book about it and I feel maybe it's bliss or something, I don't pay too much attention to it. But I'm not yet where I can really experience it that way. But he was. And he noticed that, therefore, since it is our reality, the reality of all life, is this bliss energy, what they call clear light of the void. They call it all kind of nirvana. He called it different things. That is the reality. The unreality is this realm of suffering of one separate egocentric person and being and animal and deity and spirit and God and demon, one single separate one after another, feeling overwhelmed by only being one against the huge vast ocean of other beings. And not against sometimes there's a harmonious interrelationship, but in life or death situations it's kind of against. And so one feels overwhelmed by the vastness. And one feels one can never have enough. And other beings want something from oneself. And one feels frightened. And one feels dissatisfied. And one feels that it's no good. And it's not as bad. Temporarily, a little pleasure, a little happiness. We feel a little relief. But ordinary happiness out of that kind of a matrix of awareness, of me versus the universe, from Buddha's point of view, is basically suffering. And happiness in that framework, he calls it the suffering of change, because it won't last. You know, we never have enough, right? Or maybe some people here have enough. Maybe you already have enough of me. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. But anyway, that's the basis of it. Imagine that. It's a preposterous kind of thing, in a way. If you think about it, who can really proclaim that reality is bliss? And I know that, and I discovered that, and not only my reality, your reality, every reality. And not only that, but I used to think it was misery. And by understanding it, I found it was bliss. And that therefore, because I used to be like that, you also can understand it like that. So, but you can't, it won't help you just to even believe what I say, necessarily, like some sort of blind faith. Oh, it seems like a crap to me, but he says it's bliss, so I'll believe it's bliss. That won't really help you. What you have to do is you have to critically investigate why you don't think it's bliss, why you think what is unreal is real, and why you think what is real is unreal, why we're upside down, in fact, from Buddha's perspective. And bit by bit, you can come to that understanding through a process of education. Okay. Bye. Oh, Shantam, yes. Okay, bye. Bye, Shantam. Thank you. So that's the basis of, in a way, the basis of all Buddhism, is Buddha's discovery. And then, of course, you know, people very much misunderstand that, because those of you who know a lot or a bit about Buddhism know that the first thing he taught to people once he was enlightened was something called the Four Noble Truths. And the first of those noble truths was that the unenlightened life is suffering. Although he didn't say it, he said it. He was a little naughty Buddha, I think, sometimes, like the Dalai Lama is. He liked to be a little mischievous, and he just said, all this is suffering. So people naturally overextended what all this meant. And what he meant was all this, the way they see the world, is suffering, meaning the unenlightened life is suffering. And then he said, and the reason that there's a cause for that, and the cause is this delusion that you have, that you are the one real thing in the world, and which puts you in a state of disagreement with everybody else in the world, because they all think they're the one real thing in the world, and then they know you don't agree with that, so it's Hobbes, war of all against all, because everybody's the one thing, and therefore nobody agrees with them, and everybody's paranoid, right? Except mom, I would say mom thought you were the one thing in the world for a little while. and then maybe your lover did think so too for a while. So that's the thing. So that changed India over 1,500 years, about 1,200 years by the time that this education system, civilization system, social system, spiritual system came to Tibet. Was 1,200 years. And so Buddha measured it out, so to speak. It was, you know, there's this change, there has to be social change. People have to, if you go right away and say everything is bliss and just emphasize that only that point, then there could lead to a lot of misunderstanding and disbelief. So the Buddha kind of built it up slowly over a thousand years. And then coming back to this on page 16 and 17, the first 500 years, he emphasized individualism. Because before that, people were too much into, well, the caste system and a collectivist kind of society where you're part of the system and you have to do what your mother did if you're female, you have to do what your father did if you're male, and you, whatever your caste level is, that's what you have to do, and you just do whatever you're supposed to do. You're like a cog in a machine. You know, you're a farmer. If your dad was a farmer, you plant and you produce food for the world. It's a collectivist idea. The idea that you as an individual have a destiny separate from your collectivity is not dawned that much in ancient, in pre-Buddhist, pre-Jain, pre-Upanishadic India. That's like more than 2,500 years ago. It wasn't very much emphasized. They were more or less living in a one-world thing where you're part of a collective. And so he's emphasized that individualistic style, and he created an institution where anybody who wanted to drop out of their collective duty, like he had, could go and seek, because there was no universities in that time. There was no general education in that time. There was apprenticeship and your parental education, and occasionally some larger, like religious school or something, but not universal, no universal education, because the caste system was so divided, right? So that enabled lots of people. Then there is one thing, Buddha, he was a little He's been criticized by modern scholars, by feminist scholars, that he was a little hesitant about women when his ex-wife and his, after he was a teacher and a monk, his ex-wife and his foster mother showed up at the monastery and said, we want to join, we want to be monks, we want to be nuns. He said, no, it's not necessary, just hang out at home and relax. And then they followed him around barefoot in the rain, and they made a big fuss about it, and they asked again, and then they finally got their cousin, who was his attendant, his cousin also, to plead with him, plead their case, and he finally agreed. But he said he was hesitant, and then they scolded, oh, he was a chauvinist, and blah, 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 they were going on like that, but not really. The reason he hesitated, he gave his reason. They said, well, do you think women can't get enlightened? He said, oh, no, easier than the men. No problem, they can get enlightened, he said. Well, then why can't they join? Well, he said, because if they do, it will shorten the life of the order. It will shorten the life of this institution. And what he meant by that was what did happen, which is that women came out in much greater numbers than men. Huge numbers, because remember, in that kind of social system, you're married at 12 to some old, terrible character, no romance, no way, some family-arranged thing to benefit the family. You're sold off. And then you have maybe 12, 15 childbirths before you're 30, and half of them, or a quarter of them, survive. And you work in the field all the time. You do all the work, cooking, everything, washing the dishes. And you have no chance to educate yourself. You're a prisoner of the extended family system. And so naturally, oh, I can drop out and fulfill myself? Whoa! It was a stampede. It's like the nuns were like charging. Actually, they still are in China, in free China. The nuns are in Taipei. If you don't look out and you want to watch the traffic sign, there's like a herd of nuns goes by. Wham! And they all have PhDs, and they're engineers, some of them, and they're still nuns, and they're just very cheerful and busy and energetic and creative. They're amazing, actually. I really like them. I think they're marvelous. Still, because it's an alternative to a very oppressive social system. And the Indian patriarchs, naturally, no longer can sell off your daughter to some other family to benefit the family if the daughter wants to be fulfill herself and become enlightened. And then there are some songs of the early nuns. I love them. There's one particular one where she just has finished a free lunch that someone else prepared. And all she does is wipe out her one bowl, put it in her little sack, and she says, Buddha, if this isn't nirvana, it's close enough. You helped me escape from three crooked things. One was my rice-pounding pestle with which I had to husk the rice. The second was my hunchback mother-in-law. No, my grumpy mother-in-law. And the third was my hunchback husband. And so, thank you very much. My mind and life is straightened out. You know, it's like a poem like that from one of the early enlightened nuns. You know, there are many, many like that. So that was 500 years. Then, in the second 500 years, there's what I call messianic Buddhism, or bodhisattva Buddhism. You know, bodhisattva means a being who says, well, yes, I want to become enlightened and free of suffering, but I realize even before I am that I can't be fully enlightened and free of suffering unless everybody's free of suffering and fully enlightened. So I'm going to be a Buddha for the sake of all beings. I'm not just going to seek my personal nirvana. And because, in a way, because I realize there is no such thing, because everything is totally interconnected. It's a sort of philosophical further step, at least we think so. So, you know, some of the Buddhists do think so. The Mahayana, it's called the Mahayana, or universalistic style. So after the individualistic style, then there's a universalistic style, altruistic style, messianic Buddhism. And that's a dominant movement in Indian Buddhism from approximately zero of the Common Era to 500 of the Common Era. And then that, and those two together, and by the way, that style, the way that Western people teach it, they teach that the Mahayana and the Hinayana or the Theravada are enemies. They're like opposites. They're fighting. They're in debate, which is not at all true. And they say that the Mahayana was invented when the monks got bored and unpopular, and they decided they would have a kind of more divine sort of social gospel they would promote. But that's completely ridiculous, because in India, anybody can start a religion. You know, we have like 10 people who are God in India today. They have big hairdos and they run around. They have like thousands and millions of disciples. And sometimes there's a couple that is God. There's a couple in South India. They're very nice and they're great. And that ladies can be God. You know, it's easy in India to have a religion going. They're very spiritual, the Indian people. And so why would you associate it with something if it was unpopular? What the Messianic Buddhism was the outreach from the well-established monastic individual bastion of the person who wanted to drop out. And then once they're well-established, they can go there like into a university and get educated and learn to control their self-centeredness, understand the deep philosophy of selflessness, emptiness, as it's called, or selflessness, and cultivate the vast compassion and so forth. And then, from that basis, reach out into the society, into the layperson's zone, and say, now and there, you should change the way you behave. Before, the monastic group said, well, if you leave that corrupt world and come into this higher level world, then you can live better and you can become more enlightened, but we're not going to interfere with how they run the world because it's a hopeless case. It's all corrupt. You know, it's like unsatisfying and it's samsara, you know. But the Mahayana people say, yeah, you can come out and you can develop and you can cultivate and you become enlightened, you become happier, and then you should reach out into the society and see that they do it even in place without everybody having to drop out. But the one key point is that those Mahayana Buddhists built more monasteries than the earlier individual people had built because they realized that still was the educational foundational place, you know, to really drop out. Because as we know, when we work day and night and up and down, you know, it's very hard to really have time to develop ourselves, right? We do know that, do we not? And we all have the American disease, probably most of us, which is busyness, super busyness, no time. You know? I remember this one Lama once who was visiting here in the 70s. And a great Lama from, you know, reincarnate Lama, and then it was leaving after 3 or 4 or 5 months traveling around America and visiting Native American people as well as Euro-American people in cities, Native American people in the countries and reservations. And at the end, one of his hosts asked him in this public farewell thing, well, Rinpoche, how did you enjoy your time in America? And he said, oh, it's nice, I enjoyed, and you know, there's beautiful roads and houses and a lot of nice things, he says, But you know, finally, he said, it just was a little bit too much like communist China. And everybody goes like, ah, what do you mean? Because this particular Rinpoche had been with His Holiness in the 50s when he visited Mao, you know, down in Beijing, in the early part of the Chinese invasion. And then they said, well, how can that be, Rinpoche? This was in the 70s, you know, people were like, what? And he said, well, of course, here there's more wealth, and because that was still the 70s. And, you know, people are better off and there's less coercion and stuff. But the thing that is similar is that everybody all the time is busy. Nobody ever has any time. And then he gave us an example. He stayed in a very wealthy house somewhere in some city. And the guy was so kind to him and hospitable and said, Rinpoche, it's so nice to have you visit. And then that was like the last he saw of the guy because he was like some sort of stockbroker and he had like 3 phones and it was like, you know, like, no time to talk to his guest. And so that was like the work brigades he had seen in the early 50s, you know, in China. Everybody's work, 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 go out there, you know, kill all the birds, harvest all this, do that, do the other. You know what I mean? It was constant slaving away, you know. And that was a shock anyway. So then he gave a thing about in Tibet. He said, we worked very hard sometimes. We would have exams. We would perform rituals. We would go do meditation. He said, but even in the villages, you know, not necessarily the monasteries, but he said, then sometimes in some seasons, we would just hang out. We would just do nothing for weeks on end. And then we'd get ready and do a harvest or, you know, whatever it would be. And he said that he missed that break in rhythm, you know, a sort of cooling out, not this high pressure time thing that we're all stuck in. Anyway, So then those two things, the monastic and the messianic in India, moved India into a really better place by the 5th, 6th century, much demilitarized, women much empowered and educated. I mean, still, it was a huge place even then, but big cities because so wealthy. And, you know, they had their Shakespeare in the 5th century of the Common Era, the Indian people, Kalidasa, who Goethe said was the greatest playwright and poet that the world ever saw, writing in Sanskrit, the great Kalidasa. And you know, they had their Wittgenstein in the 7th century and 6th century and so forth. And that was so sophisticated Indian culture at that time. And very demilitarized. And, of course, therefore vulnerable a little bit, you know. Beginning a little vulnerability, 6th, 7th, 8th century. Some people coming in from Iran, you know, the new, especially after the Muslim movement unified many tribes. And then they started going around and conquering. Anyway, but then from 500 to 1000, you have what I call the apocalyptic style. And by apocalyptic, you know, apocalypse is not only the rapture, you know, the end of the world. Apocalypse actually just means revelation in Greek. And revelation means that more immediate, you know, become enlightened more quickly. Like remove the veil of delusion, ignorance more rapidly and not wait 1,000 lifetimes to become enlightened, but become lifetime. Sort of here and now, and that's the Tantra, the esoteric teaching, which became less esoteric and more widely known and more powerful. It's sort of like Freud and Jung, you know, this discovery of the unconscious, the learning to harness the power of the unconscious, etc. Not at all just some sort of sex orgies and weird, violent Temple of Doom rituals at all. That's not what Tantra is. There may be corruptions that are like that, but Tantra is not that. Tantra is the science of building a world of beauty based on having destroyed a world of delusion and ugliness. It's then rebuilding a beautiful world for other beings. That's what it really is. And the art and science of doing that. And then that was very, very dominant in India for 500 years. Or even the monasteries were doing that, and the universities. And so by the time around 700-800 of the Common Era, when these great adepts through who were often monks, who were bodhisattva vow holders, and who were tantric adepts, who were esoteric adepts, by the time they were heading for Tibet, they had the whole range of, like, the whole pharmacopoeia of medicines for different kinds of delusions. And what they encountered in the Tibetans were these incredibly strong-minded, semi-nomadic, very strong people with very strong women, because nomadic women are really strong. You know, they pack up these yaks and they deal with them, and they deal with the men who are a bunch of morons, like all men, but they are tough. You know, they're nomads. They live in this very high-altitude, tough place. And you know, no nomad woman tolerates misbehavior by men. They have no dowries, anthropologists. They, you know, they have all these jewels they wear in their hairdos, and those are their own screw-off money, you know. Get lost money. It's their own money. They don't have to give it to the husband, you know. If the husband misbehaves, they throw him out of the tent, period. He's out there sleeping with the yaks. And to Chinese ancient, even ancient chronicles, some people say that the Amazon myth that the Romans and the Greeks got into, you know, about the Amazons, it came from Tibet, they say. Because the Tibetan women, their Han Dynasty chronicles, they say, those Tibetans, they're really scared of their women. Their women are so strong. We're not, oh, we don't know about that. You know, the Chinese, you know, have their women a little bit in a box, you know. They used to have, you know. But not the Tibetans. So anyway, they reached this incredibly strong-willed-minded people, very violent at the time they first came. But they turned them into the most ardent practitioners of this. And they accomplished what had been accomplished in India in 1,500 years of social change. They accomplished it in about 500-600 years. And they became demilitarized. They lost their military power in 200-300. Because once you get more civilized, you don't want to go riding out on a horse and go beat some peasant over the head and rob his stuff and come back. You want to, like, meditate. You want to feel inner bliss. You want to understand what the world is about. You know, it's a choice you make. You know, you're not into the boring business of conquering people and just accumulating wealth and then dying and losing it. That's just a complete waste of human life from the point of view of Buddhist civilization. So this is a very good scheme for the different types of Buddhism. And you can see, you know, the first type went to Southeast Asia, the second type went to East Asia, Central and East Asia, and the third type, a little bit in Japan, a little bit in Indonesia in the ancient time, but lost there now, and a little bit in, and the massive thing of it went to Tibet. And then in the history of the tradition, the Tibetans exported this triple threat, if you will, civilizational educational method to the Mongolians, who were even rougher than anybody in history. And in Mongolia, they kind of like did them in about 400 years. So it was more fast. Even with the Mongolians, they got, in other words, they got them out of being murderous conquerors into being Om Mani Padme Hum, peaceful monks and nuns and yogis in a few hundred years, you know. And then, of course, the Indians, the Tibetans, the Mongolians became vulnerable to less developed and more violent neighbors, militarized countries, and so forth. Tibet was the last holdout because it was so inaccessible before there was modern technology of transport and military. You know, so they somehow stayed, even though they had no army for the last 400, 350 years, they still stayed uninvaded until the British went briefly and then the communist Chinese went. The nationalist Chinese never got there. So that's sort of that broad thing. Now, therefore, Tibetan Buddhism has one unique element about it, which relates to apocalyptic Buddhism. And I think I'm read what I wrote, because I like it, actually. You know, I don't always like what I write, but I do like this. To look for the essence of the Tibetan worldview, a popular Tibetan saying is a good place to start. Quote, there were three who were most kind to Tibet, the precious guru, the Lord Master, and the precious master. That is to say, Guru Rinpoche, Dzogchen, and Jey Rinpoche. And these are general terms that could apply to anybody. But everybody knows who they are. Padmasambhava, Atisha, and Tsongkhapa. You know, one Afghani, one Indian, Bengali, and one Tibetan. And, you know, although they're just generic names, who is the precious master? Oh, that's Tsongkhapa. Oh, who is the Lord master? That's Atisha. Who's the Guru Rinpoche? That's Padmasambhava. In other words, everybody knows that. The Tibetan titles could apply to any of the tens of thousands of other great figures in Tibetan history. But any Tibetan of whatever persuasion or affiliation knows immediately who is meant by the precious Guru, Lord Master, and the precious Master. The key to the whole matter is that all three of these names indicate, this is a key point, that their bearers are considered actual Buddhas in their own right. And you have to think about that. They are not thought of as mere human beings, albeit extremely holy, wise, or capable, who brought to or propagated in Tibet a teaching about Buddhas. They are clearly considered by the mass population as examples of the real thing. The essence of Tibetan culture is defined by this experience of real Buddhas dwelling among them. Now, what is amazing about that, if you think, I mean, take the West and take Jesus, or take the Messiah that is being waited for by the Jews, or the Mahdi who's being waited for by some of the Muslims. Now, that's the person, if that person is around, you're going to find true fulfillment in the presence of that person, right? And most kinds of Buddhism, Buddha's gone. You know, if Buddha was here teaching me, I'd be meditating, like I'd be doing samadhi in 5 minutes, like those people who met Buddha. But, you know, this is like Kali Yuga, I got to go to the office, you know, it's like, what, I'm just this, that, you know. And hopefully he'll come back, the next Buddha will come someday. Or Jesus will return, you know, or the Mahdi will show up, or the Messiah will come. So, in other words, most religions and cultures, which are connected to religions, are kind of in a non-fulfillment time. They're in a between time. Things are imperfect. We're not going to really get much done. On Sunday I will feel pious in the ritual, or on Friday in the synagogue, or in the mosque, you know, and I'll feel really like I'm one with the highest thing, with Buddha, Body of Christ, whatever it is, or in my Zen center. But then Monday through Friday I got to work, and I got to just be an ordinary, egotistical person, or else I'll starve to death, or I'll be unhappy. So we live in this way of where we don't think that it's possible to really find fulfillment in our life. It's part of our culture that it would not be possible, so much so that if your kids show up with you and say, Mom, I just got enlightened, you would say, what have you been smoking? What did you drink? What's wrong with you? We would say. We wouldn't say, great. No, we would say, what's the matter? Or even if somebody gets too happy, you're really worried. Oh, they're manic. They're going to have a crash. It's illegal to be too happy, or to be like, practically. And yet, the Tibetans got to a point in their culture which is where India was toward the end of the first millennium, I believe. And in a way, has that still feeling about it. It's why India has such magic, even though there's a lot of mess there, problems and difficulties. But there's a kind of magic in India. like the Kumbh Mela, you know, this, you know, 30, 40 million people naked, jumping in the river, like, you know, like in the presence of the Absolute in their minds, you know. I mean, that's a big vibe, you know. It's incredible. And still, you know, even today. But that's just a fragment, I think, of what it was 1,000 years ago before the Muslim conquest and then the British conquest, the European conquest. So then it's been 1,000 years kind of mothballed, that vision. It absorbed them, though. But although it absorbed all these conquerors, it absorbed the Tajiks, who were tribals, fierce tribals who were unified by Islam, swept down there and became the Mughals, and they dragging their women in a sack behind their much more valued camels and horses. And yet, after a few hundred years, they're making Taj Mahal to their beloveds. You know? So in a way, they tamed the India's great vision of the beauty of India, tamed even that. And then the Brits, they marched in there all uptight, like with a stiff upper lip. Yes, cup of tea, whatever. And then eventually it's the Beatles chasing Maharishi around a few centuries later. And Brompton Road with some decent restaurants in London, finally, after thousands of years of eating Yorkshire pudding that's like shoe leather. So the Tibetans, so anyway, that's the thing. So however, if you're in a culture where there is a Buddha, where there is Jesus, is right there, then, you know, well, you better behave. You have a possibility. You can really live. You can be a saint if it's Christian. You can become a Buddha. It's a possibility. And then you have thousands of them who are supposedly reincarnated Buddhas. And conscious reincarnation is an ability only a highly enlightened being can muster. I'm not saying every tulku is a highly enlightened being in the Tibetan society. There may be some who just, you know, they were like, they won the lottery or something, but they don't know what they're doing, and they're maybe a little selfish and silly. There are, actually. I know a few of them, nice guys, but then there are some who genuinely are. You know? There are some genuine ones. I mean, Dalai Lama is the proof of the pudding, but there are others like that. So this is the essence of the Tibetan thing, you know, but it's just what the Indians planted there in this sort of isolated place that is inaccessible, relatively inaccessible. If you ever go up there, I don't know, how many of you have ever been to Tibet? Any of you ever been to Tibet? Andy, you've been. Now. There's no, hardly anyone, two or three, you've been. It's really, you're gasping for air when you get up there at first. You know, you have to take it very easy. And if you're in good shape, be especially careful, because you might feel a little exhilarated at first, and then you run around, then you collapse, because your lungs can't get the oxygen they need, you know, for the muscular exertion. So the slobs are cool. I'm usually cool, because I stagger around, you know. And you have to take it really easy in that altitude. So that's the thing. And then finally, okay, so then Tibetans got the full force of it, and they really lived up to it, kind of, and they did their best, and they became an example, like the Indians before them and the Mongolians after them. They became the example of what all nations on this planet, if we are to survive, have to do now. Every single one has to make a choice that we'd rather be happy than well-armed. You know, we'd rather be happy than victorious. We'd choose peace at home over violent domination outside. Because otherwise, the nations are the nations of the world based on what I call industrial tribalism, industrial militarism, are all poised to destroy themselves and everybody else. I mean, and we will not make it unless we take that lesson of history and learn to do it ourselves.